There are very few things, I suppose, as difficult for a parent as losing a child in death. It's just one of the most unnatural things that anybody would ever have to contemplate doing. What parent wouldn't gladly change places with a sick child? Wouldn't gladly lift the burden from a child in some way or the other so that they do not have to suffer in a situation where suffering is just almost inevitable? Tonight I want to talk with you from the 22nd chapter of the book of Genesis about one of the most remarkable things that we read in all of the Old Testament, without any question in my mind. What we have before us there is the story of a father and a son. We have a father who is a godly man. He lived as consistently by faith as any other person on the earth in his day and time. And we have been studying since January about his life, and we've done so because the Scriptures uphold him as an example of what a faithful person is all about and is a model for people that are trying to live by faith. And then this son, this boy by the name of Isaac, was one for, as much as we know about him, willingly followed all of his father's footsteps. He did whatever his father asked of him, and he obeyed, and he was supportive, and he loved his dad, and his dad obviously loved him. And then one day, the prospect of death raised its ugly head between them in a way that would be very, very difficult to understand or to accept. Because what we're going to be reading about tonight is a circumstance that pitted this father's deep and abiding love for his son against his loyalty to God. Talk about a predicament. Talk about a place that nobody wants to have to be. And a decision that nobody has to make. So tonight in this lesson, we're really going to be talking about how faith obeys. Now, the last time we were together, we were looking in chapter 19, and we were really talking about Lot and Sodom. And so I have skipped over chapters 20 and 21 for a reason. I'm trying to finish this series by the end of this month so we can move along to some other things that need to be done. And so I'm hoping that that's not too big of a leap to come to this point where Isaac, though he had been prophesied as one who was going to be born, has now been born and has been around for a number of years, and Abraham is going to have to decide whether or not he's going to part with this boy because there's going to be a command from his God to sacrifice him. I want you to join me tonight as we begin reading here in the first chapter, the first verse of chapter 22. And there are a lot of things that we can learn from this story, but the thing that I really want to focus most upon, in keeping with this series of lessons that we've had, is the characteristics of the faith of this father. The faith of this father. And I think what we'll see tonight in this lesson, the faith of the son. The faith of the son in his father. And then there is an obvious parallel that is to be drawn from what we're reading in Genesis chapter 22 to you and me and our Father in heaven. So that's really where we're going. And I hope it'll be useful to all of us. I don't believe God is going to ask any one of us to offer up an only child as a burnt offering. I just don't think that's ever going to happen. I know that it's not going to come from a command that Scripture is going to give us, and God is not communicating to us in some other way. But I do believe that what we will experience in our life may very well be some tests and some trials which will have similar magnitude. I know that Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12, "Do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you that comes upon you for your testing." And he doesn't really specify what that fiery ordeal was, though I think the people to whom he was writing in 1 Peter were people who were very persecuted, and so he's telling them that some of their persecutions are fiery ordeals that have come upon them. They shouldn't be shocked by this. And by extension, he's saying that to you and me, that we should not be shocked at the testing which we may have to endure as though something strange was happening to us. We're people of faith, so we should expect that our faith is going to be tested. Just mark that down. Just recognize that that's part of God's plan for us. And whenever there are tough trials that come along, these call for tough tactics. And so we're going to pay very, very close attention to this chapter. We're going to learn its lessons, and here's why. You never know, I never know, when a test is going to be laid in front of me of the same magnitude. Am I going to be faithful? Am I going to hold on to what God has said to me through His Word? Or am I going to do what my emotions and what my heart make otherwise compel me to do? Verse 1, Genesis 22. It came about after these things that God tested Abraham. And He said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Take now your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. Now, if these words sound abrupt to you and me, can you imagine how startling they sounded to Abraham? How many years has he waited on this son? And God said that Isaac would be his son of promise. And now God, out of the blue, without any warning prior to this at all, is telling him to take his only son and to offer him as a burnt offering. I've looked at this over and again, and I can't tell accurately how many years have passed between the weaning of Isaac, that child of promise, that boy that was named Laughter. Remember we talked about that? That's the meaning of his name. I don't know how many years have passed between the time that Isaac was weaned and the time of this particular commandment of God. How old is Isaac at this point? Is he an adolescent? Is he a teenager? He's obviously old enough to be away from home. He's old enough to be of help to his father. I mean, he can carry a load from where they stop to where the sacrifice is going to be made. He's very observant. He can communicate. So he's not a kid, I don't think. He's not a grown man, but he could be. I'm not quite sure where he is in life. But what I do know is that from the time that Isaac was weaned and a separation took place where Ishmael and his mother went their way, that there hasn't really been any recorded communication from heaven. It's widely held that Isaac was a young man by the time that Abraham received this commandment. So after an apparently extended period of silence from God, suddenly this command, of all commands, comes to Abraham, and how strange this must have sounded to his ears. I mean, he had waited 25 years from the time that the promise was first made till Isaac was born. And now that same God wants this boy killed. How does that make sense? And I believe it didn't make sense, at least not to Abraham. It probably wouldn't have made sense to you or to me if we had been given this commandment either. And that's the great part of the difficulty of this test. When God expects things of us that do not make sense to us, it's not the way we would do it. We don't understand what's trying to be done here. And what's the most common question we ask when we have a trial? What's the most often asked question that comes to people who are being tested? Isn't it, why? Why? Why now? Why this? Why me? Aren't those commonly asked questions? We feel that if we're going to endure it, we at least ought to be told why. That we ought to at least be given a rationale for what we're to learn from this. And how come this is happening? And yet, if God gave Abraham a reason going into this, it is not recorded. All He did was give him this command to take his son, his only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I will tell you. A single sentence, a clearly stated expectation, no further explanation, no opportunity to question God about all of this, and to get further information that would help him settle this in his mind. Years ago, it's not as often done now, but used to, we would call a number, maybe a company that you're doing business with, maybe somebody to whom you owe a little money, and you've got some questions or you need to make some arrangement, and you call them and they give you this menu, and it says if you don't understand, if you have a question, press 1, whatever. Well, Abraham didn't get the if you don't understand this commandment, press 1. He didn't get that if you disagree with this commandment, press 2. If your insides churned when you first heard this commandment, press 3. If you'd rather not do this, just hang up. No, he didn't get any of that. He just got this commandment. Just 2 choices. You either go and do what I tell you, or you stay here and disobey me. What would we have done had this been put on our plates? And I'm sure that the millions upon millions of people through history who have read this passage have asked themselves that question. And so we need to put ourselves in that spot tonight. Suppose God should resurrect Abraham for us. Suppose he could visit with us here tonight at Sci-Fair. And we were to have him at our disposal to ask him about what he thought and what his reaction was. What do you think he would tell us? Father Abraham, friend of God, survivor of one of the greatest tests men have ever been called on to take, tell us how to do this. Tell us what was going through your mind when God asked this of you. Tell us how faith obeys God. And I think Abraham would give some answers based on what we see in this text. I believe, first of all, that if Abraham were with us tonight, he would say to us that faith obeys God. Promptly. Look at verse 3. So Abraham rose early in the morning. He saddled his donkey. He took 2 of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Now I want you to look at all the verbs in those verses. Look at them in that verse 3. There's the verb arose, saddle, took, split, went. He's busy. Verbs are action words. He's doing something. He's not sitting still. He's not sitting on his hands. He's not hesitating. That's how this text presents it. God commanded him. Abraham gets busy. God commanded it. Abraham goes into action. He takes his son. He leaves from Moriah. Do you think he got much sleep that night? Do you know what kind of thing would have been on his mind that night? All the joy that Isaac had brought, he and Sarah, over these years, and all the things that were going on in his mind at that time. Do you suppose at all that he wrestled with God in his thoughts, just like his grandson Jacob, Isaac's son, will someday do, and end up being called Israel as a result of having wrestled with God over something God decided? Can you imagine the struggle this man has? Besides the obvious personal loss of his beloved son Isaac, what other questions might have been on Abraham's mind? Is Sarah on his mind? Surely. He's wondering about how he's going to tell Sarah. How's he going to explain this to her? I mean, she is as attached to this son as any mother has ever been attached to a son. She waited for a long, long time. And Ishmael was no substitute, you see, for this son that came from her own body. If he kills Isaac, how's he ever going to come back home? What's he going to say to her? What's he going to do with her? What are the Egyptians going to say once the word starts spreading around that Abraham has slain his only son Isaac, the son of promise? What about the Canaanites? What about the Perizzites? Some of them do this routinely. And I'm sure that Abraham has been aghast at what they have done in sacrificing their sons. All of these Canaanite neighbors of Abraham, when they learn that God has required him to sacrifice his only son, what's that going to mean? And what is going to become of God's promise? I mean, this is the most important thing here. What did God promise Abraham long ago? He promised, I will bless you, and I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you, and I will make of you a great nation. There will be many descendants, as many as the sand of the seashore and the stars in the heavens. And how is God going to do that if my only heir here is going to be dead? And then on top of all of that, how is he going to deal with his own personal grief as a dad? He's going to lose this boy. And he's not just going to lose this boy because of a car accident, or even because of a drug overdose, God forbid, but because of his own hand. How do you deal with that? And there wasn't any answer forthcoming about all of this. All Abraham had to go on was a command from God that seemed to go against everything he knew to be good and right. And I just will have to say as I read this that in my own personal nature, when I don't want to do something, or if I don't fully understand something I'm being asked to do, my first inclination is to procrastinate. Let's put this off and let's just ignore this as long as we possibly can. I suspect all of us are kindred spirits in that regard. But there's something to learn here. In other settings, you've heard me recommend deliberate caution whenever we have to make a major decision. Proverbs 20 and verse 25 cautions about making a quick decision. It says it is a snare to say it is holy and then after the vows to make inquiry. In other words, you need to ask all your questions prior to making the decision. Don't make the decision and then later on realize, oh, I didn't think about that. I didn't think about that. I didn't think about that. Because if you do, you will have made a colossal mistake. And yet that kind of hesitation, that kind of caution about making a decision to go forward is for when we do not know the will of God clearly. And in cases like that, we have to take time to ascertain what God wants us to do. But this situation isn't one of those situations. Abraham knew what God wanted him to do. There wasn't any question about what God wanted. He didn't know why, but he certainly knew what. My granddaddy, my pawpaw, White, he used to say to me as a boy, I remember this, in circumstances where I would be hesitant to do a certain thing, he'd say, you'd better go now before you lose your nerve. I can still hear him say that to me. He taught me how to ride a bicycle. He grabbed the back of that seat, had on his Liberty overalls, and off we went down a pasture one day over some terraces, and he was steadying that bike, and I did not want to ride that bike, and I was scared of a crash, and he just kept telling me every time I'd get on it and tease about trying to learn. He said, you better go now. You'll lose your nerve. You'll lose your nerve. And off we went. And I learned how to ride a bike by doing that. Maybe that is the kind of thing behind Abraham's promptness. Once you understand what it is God wants you to do, it doesn't get easier to obey it if you put it off. So Abraham got up that morning obeying God. He got up that morning getting ready. And that's the first thing that you have to do as a person of faith, is just get to the business of doing what God asks of you to do. Now, I believe that Abraham would also tell us that what we need to do is to obey God independently. And faith always operates very independently. Look at verse 3 again. Abraham is rising early. Abraham's doing all of these things. He's taking two of his young men with him. He's taking Isaac, his son. They're going to the place where God has told him to go. Abraham, when he went on this mission to obey God, took only who was absolutely necessary to the accomplishment of this task. He needed these servants to help him carry the items for the sacrifice, the provisions, the help that they could give in getting to the place. But it appears to me that he didn't tell anybody about this mission before he left home. If he did, he didn't tell them the nature of it. Can you imagine the fit that Mother Sarah would have thrown had she known what Abraham was planning to do that morning? Remember how adamant she was about getting rid of Ishmael so that Isaac could come front and center? This is not a woman who would have put up with this very easily. She's a mama bear guarding her cub. And we can understand that. No, this was something that God commanded Abraham to do, and it was between God and Abraham. And in verse 4, it says that on the third day, that means the third day from setting out to go to the place where the sacrifice was going to be made, on the third day, Abraham raised his eyes. He saw the place from a distance. The distance from Beersheba, where he was, to Moriah, the mountain on which he was going to sacrifice Isaac, was about 50 miles. Took him 3 days to make the journey, but it was about 50 miles from Beersheba to Moriah. And by the way, there's something else we learned from 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1, that Mount Moriah will eventually be the place where Solomon's temple will be built years later. And the place where Isaac was going to be offered was later on going to become the site of the whole Old Testament system of sacrifice. The temple would be there. So in verse 5, Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you." Note that Abraham didn't take the servants to the actual place where the sacrifice was going to be made. What could they do to help anyway, other than express their horror when they saw what Abraham was about to do? No, this act was between Abraham and his God alone. Others would not understand. Other people might try to talk him out of it. Other people might try to influence him to do differently. They might raise questions in his mind about whether or not he had really heard God accurately. May I say to all of us tonight that there are certain aspects of our faith that must be experienced alone. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I know you're with me." But who else is there? Nobody can walk that veil for you but you or me. They can be there, they can be around us, but they don't have to do it. And it's only God that leads us through that. It's great to have the support of other people when it's available. It's helpful to ask other people's advice when we can. It's wonderful when we have other people to encourage us. But we also must understand that the root of our faith is really between us and God and no one else. And that's where it has to be. A relationship I have with God. And nobody can do that for me. Nobody can handle those things for me. Remember when Jesus began to reveal His coming crucifixion to His disciples, and Peter vowed that he would never let such a thing happen? And how did Jesus respond to Peter saying, "I'm going to stop this business of crucifixion"? He looked at Peter and he said, "You get behind me, Satan." He calls Peter the devil. He says, if you could stop this, you would be thwarting God's purposes. Peter's interference, though it was well-intentioned, would only keep Jesus from fulfilling God's mission. And there are some things we must pass through alone. And for Abraham, it was Moriah. And years later, for Jesus, It will be Golgotha. We'll have our lonely times when we have to obey independently. You can just mark that down. Because there will be times when other people will not understand the commitment we've made to God, and they will try to interfere, they will try to intervene, they will try to stop us from doing what we know is right. And so the question is, will your faith stand if you have to do what you have to do alone? Well, Father Abraham, what other tough tactics would you advise for the most difficult trials of our life? I believe if he were here, he would say that faith obeys confidently. While it's still difficult, it would be easier for you and me if we were to receive a commandment to take our son or our sons and offer them up on an altar. It would be a little easier for you and me to do that because we know what Abraham probably did not know. He did not know the outcome of this. We know what happened in this story. We know that God stopped Isaac's death at the last moment. But it is when we do not know what is going to happen that we have our greatest problems with faith. When we don't know what's going to happen next, after I do this. A quick reading of these verses might give us the mistaken idea that Abraham just resigned himself to the thought that he was going to lose Isaac for good and that God was unjust in his dealings, but that's not what we see going on here. There is a single word in verse 5 that tells me something about Abraham's disposition. Did you see it when we were reading it? He said, "You servants, you stay right here and you tend to this donkey, and I and the lad we'll go over there and we will worship and return to you." We will return to you. Abraham obeys God in the confidence that his son, some way or the other, is going to be returned to him. Abraham was expecting to get Isaac back. He didn't know how. He didn't know when. He only knew that God had promised that his descendants would be named through this boy. And that could only happen if this boy were alive and if he were to have a family. The New Testament writer of Hebrews tells us what was on Abraham's mind. We don't have to wonder about that, because in chapter 11 of Hebrews verse 17, he says, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, 'In Isaac your descendants shall be called.'" Notice this. Listen carefully. "He considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, which he also received him back as a type." How did Abraham come to the conclusion that God might raise Isaac from the dead? How many resurrections do you suppose Abraham has ever seen in his lifetime? None recorded in Scripture. Abraham's thinking was a deduction, you see. God had promised to bless him with descendants through that boy. How could he do that if this boy did not live to produce a family? There was only one way, and that was that even if Abraham takes that boy's life, God can raise him from death. And that was what was on his mind. That God has promises to fulfill through Isaac. And so we should not be shocked that in Romans chapter 4, verse 21, that Abraham was fully assured that what God promised, he was able also to perform. That, my friends, is faith. If there is a better definition of what real saving faith is than that, I just don't know what it would be. The rock-solid trust that God is going to do whatever He has to do to keep His promises even when it seems to be impossible to do. And that's what faith is all about. But finally tonight, I would suggest to you that Abraham also would teach us that faith obeys completely. Look at verse 6. "Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering. He laid it on Isaac his son. He took it in his hand, the fire, the knife. The two of them walked on together. And Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, 'My father.' And he said, 'Here I am, my son.' And he said, 'Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering. And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. How difficult that must have been for Abraham to climb up that hill and to hear this question that came from his son. And then that gut-wrenching feeling that one would get when you realize your son is just processing all of this and he's going to eventually come to the conclusion that maybe he, in fact, is the sacrifice. And so by the time you get to verse 9, they come to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac. If Isaac didn't know until this point, he knows now that he's going to be laid on this altar that his father has built, that he will be the lamb that will be offered up. And you can only imagine the unspoken looks that must have passed between this daddy and his boy as he's tying him up and as he's readying the fire, as he's getting him ready for this sacrifice. They knew what was going to happen. And yet it appears from everything we read here, Isaac didn't even lift a finger of resistance. Now Abraham's an old man. He's well over 100 years of age. I guess that Isaac, being younger, could have wrestled himself away from this old man and run away. I mean, he could have done that. Physically, he could have done it. But no, what does Isaac do? He submits to his father. He does what his father asks him to do. And to me, Isaac's submission to his father is as remarkable as Abraham's submission to his father. Don't leave Isaac out of the faith equation. He's placing his faith in his father, in being a righteous man, doing what God has asked him to do. And there is no struggle recorded. Verse 10, Abraham stretches out his hand. He takes up the knife to slay his son. He's fully ready to kill him. Isaac, though it must have grieved him beyond words, he's going to do what his father demands. And Abraham is going to obey God, hoping against hope that God will somehow make this right so that the promises that have been made to him can be fulfilled. And so in my mind's eye, I can see that knife. That knife has been raised. It's going to be plunged into the body of this son. You can almost see the glint of the sun on that sharp blade. The deed is going to be done. Abraham is resigned to the fact that he will plunge this knife into his son's chest. And in verse 11, the angel of the Lord called to him. He calls to him from heaven. And he says, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. I'm going to tell you, Hollywood could never produce drama like this, ever. It would be impossible. What a story this is. We have here a picture of complete obedience. That's faith. Doing whatever is called upon us to do. Then Abraham raised his eyes. He looked. Verse 13 says, behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided. And so the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, verse 16, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men. They arose and they went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. What a story. And as we read through it, did you ever find yourself wondering how a loving God could ever ask somebody as faithful as Abraham to sacrifice his son? I've had no telling how many people say that to me. Well, if God was such a loving God, why would He put Abraham in such a predicament? If He really loved Abraham, why would He do that to him? Well, let me tell you, this is not a picture of an evil God. It's a picture of extreme love. God stopped Abraham from killing his son. But when it came time for him to offer his son, he did not stop. Because it was through the life of that son that all of us are blessed through that sacrifice. This story of Abraham and Isaac is nothing more than just a little bit of foretaste of what the story about God's love for humankind is all about in the giving of His only begotten Son for the sins of mankind. I've seen people with tears when they've read the story of Abraham. Maybe you've shed a few tonight. Maybe you've thought about this seriously. Can you scoff at a story like this? Can you mess around with a truth like this? Can we see this and not be moved to gratitude for what God did through His own Son? If we can read a story like this and not be touched by it, then the story of Jesus on a cross probably isn't going to make much difference to us either. And let me just say this as forthrightly as I can. If I'm talking to somebody tonight that the story of the cross does not affect, there's no hope for you. You're lost. And you're going to stay that way. And you're going to stay that way until your heart can be tenderized to the point that you see the love that God had for you in giving His only begotten Son on the cross. We should be moved to offer God obedience and to offer God praise for His sacrifice on our behalf. So give God your life, because His sacrifice for you was nothing less than His Son's life. And that, my friends, is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Remember Abraham being told, or we're being told, that the gospel was preached beforehand to Abraham, Galatians 3 and verse 8. Here you have it. Here you have it. If I'm speaking to someone tonight that needs to put on Christ, you've given thought to it, you believe, you don't have a question about whether or not Jesus is God's Son. You know that you're a sinner and that you need to repent of wrongs because those aren't doing you any good eternally or probably temporally. And all you lack is being baptized into Christ. Then this is the moment for you to do what you know in your heart is the right thing to do. Obey the gospel, become a child of God, and partake of the blessing that God promised Abraham so long ago would accrue to all of humanity through the death of His only begotten Son. We sing this song to encourage your obedience, and we hope you'll come forward and let us know how we can help as we stand and sing.